This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Brandy, Tom and Richard having a look at some of the big stories shaping the news agenda at the start of a new week. And that includes a major presidential meeting in Egypt. The president of the UAE and Egypt coming together to discuss what's going on in the region, but also to have a look at trade and investment ties on the back of that $35 billion investment from ADQ. Carla Slim is the regional economist from Standard Chartered Bank. She's been putting it all into context for us, as well as having a look at what might be on a shopping list for the UAE and Saudi Arabia as Egypt prepares to sell around 30 state-owned assets. We've also been looking at the US shutdown that wasn't, again, with Professor Adam Ramey of New York University, Abu Dhabi. Meanwhile, IT6 says that it's seen a 60% spike in attempted cybercrimes here in the UAE in Ramadan. Why so? The fabulously voiced Emma Colazade, founder and CEO of IT6, been running us through his theories.
One of the big stories over the weekend was, Brandy Scott, the visit to Egypt by the UAE president, his Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed. Economics wasn't the only thing on the agenda, but clearly being the business breakfast, that's what you've been picking up on, yeah?
Yeah, and that's what we're going to be focusing on. We're going to speak to Carla Slim a little bit later on. She is the regional economist for Standard Chartered. The reason we are particularly so interested in this visit with our business breakfast head on is because it follows a massive investment into Egypt from ADQ, the sovereign wealth fund in Abu Dhabi. Tens of billions of dollars that are going to go into developing a section of the Mediterranean coast, and the man who signed that deal is there as well. So we're going to look at what might come next, what it's going to mean for Egypt. It was already transformational for the free float of the currency, and how it fits into some other things that are going on in Egypt, including a bit of a pause on some government projects and a lot of transformation of the way things work that often come with assistance of places like the World Bank.
Yeah, I was at a kid's birthday party yesterday, and one of the topics of conversation, the parents were there, is it okay to go to Egypt on holiday this Eid al-Fitr, given the uncertainty we have in the region? Forgive the euphemism, but you know what I'm talking about. And that was a question, and some people said, yeah, that's fine, I would happily go to Sharm el-Sheikh or to Cairo or wherever it may be. Others were a little bit more reticent about that, but it is a conversation that people are having at the moment. Looking forward to seeing Carla this morning, live in the studio, in just about 20 minutes' time, Carla Slim of Standard Chartered. And before that, we're going to be talking all things Trump. We know his media company listed last Thursday, a complex deal called a SPAC, Special Purpose Acquisition Company. Shares doing really well on Thursday, falling 14% on Friday. Going to be getting Professor Ramey's take on that. More seriously, a $1.2 trillion deal to keep the US government open. That was signed by Joe Biden over the weekend. And just generally, taking the pulse of the US economy, it is an election year. What's going on? Adam Ramey is following that one closely. Also following the markets this morning, back up and running on a Monday after a tumultuous week. Half the world's interest rates were set last week. This week is very different. We've got, you know, like some housing data, and it's nothing like the flurry of economic data had last week. So we asked Sean Walter, senior economist at Emirates NBD, what's going to be moving markets this week?
After a very busy week last week, with several large central banks announcing interest rate decisions, this week is significantly quieter on the economic data front, particularly with holidays in India today and across much of Europe and the US on Friday. Investors are, however, likely to be watching for clues on future monetary policy direction from a host of central bank officials due to speak at various events this week, including the ECB's Christine Lagarde and Philip Lane. In addition, markets will be watching data out of the US, including durable goods orders and personal spending and income data for February. Then right at the end of the week, we have the release of the Fed's preferred measure of inflation, the core PCE deflator, for which the Fed has a 2% target. Consensus expectations are currently for this measure of inflation to remain unchanged from January at 2.8% year-on-year in February.
Sean Walters, Emirates NBD. Staying with the markets, Tom, just picking up on the story you mentioned in the currency report about, 10, 15 minutes ago now, Indian rupee at a record low against the dollar. and by extension against the dirham. Great news if you're in the UAE and you're going to India over the Ramadan, Eid al-Fitr, school holiday, whatever it is. But for Indian tourists coming here, it's going to be more expensive. Almost 23 now Indian rupees against the dirham at the moment. If you're arriving on a flight from Bangalore, one dirham is going to cost you almost 23 rupees. That makes an expensive place already more expensive. What's the story, Tom? Just recap.
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit of a sort of head-scratcher, really, in many ways, because, I mean, one story that we can tell you about is strong dollar. We've seen that. And that seems to have gone in line with the rise and the sort of re-establishment of Bitcoin in recent time. Ordinarily, you'd think to see cryptos going up and therefore dollar would be weak, but no, dollar remains strong. The Indian rupee, though, a lot of people saying that there's just broad weaknesses in Asian financial markets at the moment, and the aggressive demand for dollar is on the back of that as well. So whilst a few jitters amongst the Asian currencies, that's created more of an appetite for the local dollar demand. But also a little bit of concern over in India that the RBI, the Reserve Bank of India, have not intervened. They would have thought that when you've seen that sort of significant decline in the value of the Indian rupee against the dollar, but no intervention, no word from Reserve Bank of India, and that has got a few foreign exchange traders also concerned at the moment. I mean, it's not the end of the world. As I said, things seem to be holding steady early Monday morning after those runs on Friday afternoon. But it's a weird one, because I mean, you look at India, economy's booming, you know, lots going on there at the moment. There's a lot of demand for investment into and out of India. And yet problems with the currency. Well, it's not a problem, is it? I mean, it's not a problem for itself. The only problem is strong dollar.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Right, let's look in more detail at one of those top stories this morning. Two presidents, ours and theirs, meeting in Cairo to discuss many things, including economic ties. We are very pleased to be joined by Carla Slim, who is the MENA economist. So she looks after this region for Standard Chartered Bank. Carla, it's lovely to see you again. Good morning.
Good morning, Brandy. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
So that $35 billion deal is one of the big things we've been talking about with Egypt recently. ADQ expanding, amongst other things, to develop a very large chunk of the Mediterranean coast. How does that fit into what we do see economically between the UAE and Egypt?
So you've mentioned there's a political angle to these meetings, but there's also a very large and substantial economic angle. Now, the UAE and Egypt have had both political ties and economic ties historically. The UAE deems Egypt as being the political valve of the region, so stability. Egyptian stability is very important for, obviously, Egypt, but also for the region, and even, I would argue, globally, stability is very important. These economic ties are also long-standing and historic. We've seen a lot of investment, not just from ADQ, but various entities based in the UAE, whether government-related or just private sector, invest in Egypt because it's the most populous country in the Arab world, but also 14th largest population globally, and a very, very diverse economy as well. They have a very diverse range of sectors that one can be attracted to, whether it's manufacturing, trade, having the Suez Canal, tourism, but also LNG. It's often missed that Egypt is a net hydrocarbon balanced country, meaning that the value of their crude oil imports is equal to the value of their LNG exports in good times, not in current times, but in good times. They're not a net hydrocarbon importer. They're balanced. So that's also a huge opportunity.
Well, let's have a look at the ADQ deal in general, which is a deal of two parts. So the first part, we have $24 billion going into that Ras Al Hekma development. It allowed the free float of the Egyptian pound. Tell us why that's important.
So actually, let's take stock of how much money from that ADQ $35 billion announcement has already gone through before the FX adjustment. So you mentioned that there were different tranches and different disbursements that were coming due. The first disbursement was $10 billion of a fresh inflow, we're not counting what was already Central Bank of UAE money with the Central Bank of Egypt that got converted from a deposit to an investment, because that was already in Egypt. Fresh FX inflow was $10 billion before the FX adjustment, and that ushered in more money from other places. So foreign investors who had exited Egypt in the aftermath of the Ukraine invasion that led to an emerging market sell-off, we saw a capital outflow of about $20 billion at the time. And that was a large reason why Egypt fell into its dollar liquidity shortage in the first place. They have returned. And they have returned en masse. There's about $10 billion of portfolio investors who came back. And the combination of both of that and the ADQ $10 billion has changed the liquidity profile and led to the FX adjustment that we've seen so far. Now, the risk is that it may not be a full flotation of the Egyptian pound, because the way we saw the Egyptian pound overshoot to 50 and then come back was looked a bit, you know, managed, in a sense that it showed the FX inflows, but also is very nicely retracing back to our target for the Egyptian pound towards the end of the year.
How does it all fit into some reforms that we're seeing in Egypt at the moment? $11 billion from ADQ is going to go into other real estate and other projects. We've got that World Bank aid package, and the World Bank likes to see reform along with its aid packages. And one of the things is a spending rationalisation plan for investment, which means a lot of things aren't going to get built that were on the drawing board. How does all of this come together?
It's been very important for the IMF, for the World Bank, for international investors that Egypt slow down its infrastructure spend, because they've done a lot of good things in the last few years and in the last decade or so. But it needed to slow down a bit, because this infrastructure investment relies and requires a lot of dollars to pay for large ticket imports. This is the reason why they needed it to slow down. The fact that ADQ will now be responsible for this investment alleviates some of the burden from the budget, and that's going to help from a sustainability, debt sustainability point of view, because many in the market had become concerned that Egypt probability of default was rising before ADQ stepped in with the announcement. So yes, we are going to see a step back on the infrastructure investment. ADQ will probably bear a bit more of the of that burden, so as to speak. And we are going to see a slowdown in the deliveries of these projects as well.
How unusual is it to see another country, and I know ADQ is a company, but it's a sovereign wealth fund, step in and do something like this?
It's not unusual. It's the size is just quite sizable. That was the surprise element. So ADQ had stepped in 2022 after the dollar shortage had been exacerbated in Egypt, but they stepped in with $2 billion investment. The fact that it was $35 billion, the biggest FDI one ticket that Egypt has seen ever, probably the biggest that the UAE has delivered as well, that was the real surprise for us watchers.
And quickly, 1 minute left with you. At the same time, reform, we've got 30 state-owned assets that are going to go up for sale to private investors in Egypt. What could that include, and what might we be interested in?
It includes banks, it includes tourist assets, it includes chemical companies, companies in the manufacturing sector, fertilizers. I think what the GCC is more interested in is everything that can complement the strategies, the diversification strategies of the GCC. So they'd be less interested in banks, because we have a quite deep banking sector in the GCC, but more interested in fertilizer or chemical companies, for example.
10 seconds, do you expect us to pick up any of those assets? Could they go to the UAE?
Yes, we expect either the UAE or Saudi, Qatar. Most of the GCC sovereign wealth funds are looking at these assets.
Carla Slim is MENA economist for Standard Chartered Bank, joining us this morning as two presidents meet in Cairo. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Brent.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Where we're talking US politics, US economics, delighted to be joined by Professor Adam Ramey of New York University, Abu Dhabi. Good morning, Professor Ramey. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
Lots to get through this morning. Can we start with the big deal over the weekend? A headline jumping out of me, $1.2 trillion deal signed by Joe Biden. Now, this is to make sure that the government didn't shut down, which sounds like quite a dramatic headline. But actually, when I read the story, I thought, hang on, this isn't economics. This is politics on Capitol Hill. At least that was my reading on it. So he signed the deal. The government isn't shut down. What's your takeaway?
I mean, this seems to be part and parcel of politics from the last decade now, more than a decade, where we have these 11th hour deals to avert a shutdown. Both sides try to hold fast to their guns, but ultimately they need to get their goodies in order to get the bill passed. You know, Republicans didn't want to see a huge amount of spending increases outside of defense. Democrats wanted to see lots of spending increases in areas except defense. And both sides had to kind of grit and bear it. And frankly, you know, these debates have been going on for months now about what the content of this spending bill should look like. And you know, we've had a Speaker of the House ousted, chaos on the Republican side. And here we are with basically the same outcome that had been negotiated months ago. So seems a lot of fanfare for a whole lot of nothing.
Yeah, that was my reading as well. It struck me that it was far less about policy and far more about personality. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if we had a professor of social science at a leading US university who'd written a book about this? So I dug into the archives and I realised that we have one, More Than a Feeling, Personality, Polarisation and the Transformation of the US Congress from 2017, written by you, Professor Ramey.
Yes. And, you know, the book that I wrote with my co-authors, Jonathan Klingler and Gary Hollibaugh, we basically explain that so much of the dysfunction that you're seeing in Congress today, so much of the pageantry, because that's really what it is. It's not, as you said, about policy. It's really about showmanship and that rise in that kind of performative politics that we've seen in American politics in the last 25, 30 years is largely explained by the kinds of personalities that we're getting into Congress these days.
Well, let's have a listen to a couple of those personalities who've been active over the weekend. It's a presidential election campaign, yeah? So it's obviously the two candidates. Let's hear first of all from Joe Biden. This was him. He posted this on his own account on X over the weekend. He was talking about healthcare. Nice images of him with Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama talking to healthcare workers. This is what Biden had to say.
This election is about two different visions of America. It's basic as that. My vision, our vision about the future, where folks have the freedom and security of affordable healthcare, low prescription drug costs, and just a little more breathing room, as my dad would say.
Trump active on X, a wide-ranging set of comments from him, video comments on his own, not on X, on his own platform, Truth Social. This was Donald Trump taking aim at Joe Biden over rising fuel prices, gasoline prices in the United States, and the inflationary impact on the economy.
So there it goes again. The price of gasoline is skyrocketing, and just like the old days under Biden and came down a little bit, but it's going up and it's going up big. It's nearing $4 a gallon in many states and much more than that in some. Prices are up almost 6% in the last month alone, and they'll be going even higher. It's going to go higher and higher. The price of gasoline affects everyone and everything. American families are paying for it not only at the pump, but also in the cost of your groceries, your package deliveries, and virtually everything you have and everything you buy.
And so it goes on. So, Professor Ramey, the role of personalities in the forthcoming election, it's not everything, but it's a big thing, isn't it?
No, it's certainly a very big deal. And I think that, you know, one of the things about former President Trump, love him or hate him, is that he has a personality style that is able to connect with a large number of mostly working class people. And originally it was mostly working class white voters, but now recent polling is showing that it's actually grown quite significantly to include large numbers of Hispanics, African Americans, and Asian Americans as well. He's got this braggadociousness, but it's not just being braggadocious. You know, Trump sort of can see what the complaints are of everyday people, and he has the ability to use his extroversion and use people's fear of the unknown, fear of uncertainty caused by inflation and rapid economic transformations in the country to be able to motivate them to come out and to vote for him. President Biden, on the other hand, you know, he's traditionally a much more conventional politician. He spent his life in the Senate just getting things done. He was a hard worker and developed a reputation as somebody who could make deals. But you know, that that didn't seem to matter so much in 2020 when there was a large amount of animosity directed toward President Trump. And there was just a sense of we need, you know, among Trump's opponents to we need to just get up and vote for Biden, no matter, you know, whether we like him or think that his personality is up to the task of running one of the most powerful countries in the world. But now as we approach 2024, I think a lot of those people, the steam has kind of run out. And Trump's personality is going to do a much better job sort of motivating the people who are inclined to support him than Biden's could in his own base.
I was reading your book, looking at what you call the big five dimensions of personality. They are openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And even without a degree in psychology, I've got my own little checklist of who's doing well in which of those categories. We talk about Trump versus Biden, which it almost certainly will be. But I was looking over the weekend at, let's call it, the implied probabilities. And third favourite in this race is Michelle Obama, with she's given a 4% chance of winning. I mean, she's an outsider, but she is the third favourite in that race. What do you make of it?
I mean, it seems very clear that certainly among Democrats, there is a desire to get somebody other than Joe Biden on the ballot. I know you wouldn't see it from the primaries, but I think that's more a function of the fact that no serious Democratic contender has wanted to get up and challenge the incumbent president. Nevertheless, I think even among Biden supporters, there is a sense that he's a little too old and he's not really up for the challenges of the job. And we need a new face to come in. And not just a new face, but a face that's able to unite different factions. I think folks look at President Obama's term in office favorably. And Michelle Obama is seen as a positive figure. She's energetic. She's warm. She's friendly. She's agreeable, if we think about the big five personality traits. And importantly, even though she's certainly on the left wing of the Democratic Party, she's somebody who, through her rhetoric and through her personality style, is able to appeal to a wide base. So that suggests to me that's why folks are thinking, you know, if Biden was to be out, she would be the perfect candidate. But that being said, I mean, barring any sort of serious health scare or unfortunate passing away at the last minute, which anything could happen with a candidate in advanced years, I think Biden is here to stay.
Great talk to you, Professor Ramey. Really appreciate your time this morning and joining us live from Abu Dhabi. That is Professor Adam Ramey, Associate Professor of Political Science at New York University, Abu Dhabi.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Ramadan Kareem to one and all, but equally, be on your guard. Why, here's a headline that caught our attention over the weekend. Cyber attacks surge in UAE during Ramadan. Recent study by Curator Labs has revealed a troubling surge in cyber attacks targeting businesses in the UAE during the holy month of Ramadan. Why is this the case? Well, best for us to ask one of the leaders in the cybersecurity industry at the moment, a cybersecurity and technology visionary who founded ITSEC back in 2013, as cybersecurity became one of the most crucial issues for businesses to tackle. He's joined us live in the studio. The founder and the CEO of ITSEC is Amir Kolazadeh, who's been kind enough to join us this Monday morning. Amir, always good to see you.
Thank you for having me, as always.
Ramadan Kareem to
Ramadan
you.
Kareem to everyone.
But as we mentioned, yeah, it comes with its risks. I suppose that the question, first and foremost, is why a spike? Why a surge during Ramadan?
It's a very interesting. So it's the first time maybe these numbers are published, but I personally have seen this happen for the past few years, right? It's the same exact thing as we were discussing right before we went live, is have you seen the number of beggars on the street on the rise? Mm. Everything else, in Ramadan being a month of forgiveness, month of charity, everybody's guards are much more down, right? And everybody's in a more relaxed mode. So the psychology of this, obviously, cyber criminals obviously are past the keystroke just to hack you. Now they're hacking the psyche of the society. We call it social engineering. Mm. When you combine a social engineering and an actual cyber attack, that's what you get, a 45% rise in a cyber attack in a special month.
Targeting the holy month of Ramadan, as you say, so defense is down a little bit, people working out of the office a bit more as well, maybe not a full staff on reduced Ramadan hours, that element of charity and humanitarian approach, as you mentioned there as well. But why the UAE? Why the focus on the UAE at the moment?
The attacks, if you look at the GCC, UAE is always number one in attacks. Obviously, the concentration of the wealth and the wealthy that we have, obviously being in the news as always, to people who has never been to UAE, all they see is glitz, right? The tall buildings, the Ferraris and Lamborghinis. So that automatically makes us a higher target than anywhere else in the world.
Mm. Is this in line with sort of rise in cyber attacks worldwide anyway? What's the start of this year been like? Has 2024 been a bad year for cyber attacks?
We always say that at the beginning of every year. Cyber attacks, they have been on the rise since 2010. When the cyber attacks started, right? There has not been a single year that we had a decrease in number of cyber attacks. They're changing their DNA. They're becoming a different type of attacks every year. As we build more defenses and we put more guards and firewalls up, the cyber criminals get smarter and are always two steps ahead of us. Mm. So I have never seen a decrease in number of cyber attacks. It's always been increasing.
If I'm a business owner listening to the show at the moment, and I'm looking to ring fence my business as best I can at the moment, are there certain businesses or rather certain industries that are more vulnerable than others when it comes to cyber attacks, or is everyone fair game?
Everyone is a fair game, 100%. There is, you cannot say because I'm in a certain type of industry, I'm not going to be a target or a victim. You would think, for example, law firms, that wouldn't be a target, right? I have several of the prominent law firms in the town as my clients who have been carefully hacked and money transferred from client accounts to Nigerian accounts. Imagine that. This is a law firm that actually is there to protect you. So no, everybody's a fair game. But yes, there are certain industries are attacked or precisely attacked for certain reasons. E-commerce, payment services, such thing like that, that actually involve financial transactions.
Could one draw a link between the fact that during the holy month of Ramadan, there are no shortage of great deals available online, you know, whether it's buying a Ramadan deal car, whether it's buying your groceries, etc. A lot of online retailers and retailers are taking advantage of the holiday periods, Ramadan being one of them, to make promotions. So therefore, there's a higher footfall or more people using e-commerce. Is that an opportunity for cyber criminals?
Definitely. That's a window. That's what we call a window. There's a window of opportunity to take more advantage, more attacks result in more responses, right? For the cyber criminals. Remember, the cyber attacks is a number of game. It's a game of numbers. The more attacks they have, the more response they get, right? So in a holy month of Ramadan, as like you said, as the increase of online users go up, they have more opportunity and more window to do attacks and get better response. Definitely.
In terms of, and I know every time we sit and every time we talk about the fact that, you know, people like yourself, organizations like yourself, trying to stay one step ahead of the criminals, but the criminals evolve very, very quickly as well. Tech industry as a whole is evolving immensely quickly at the moment.
Correct.
We can't get through a conversation without talking about AI and bots at the moment as well. Are they having an impact when it comes to cybersecurity?
100%. Definitely. On both sides of the fence, right? So we are deploying AI technologies to start doing a lot more preventive and defensive solutions. But at the same time, AI is playing into the hand of cyber criminals, and they're using it as a tool for attacks. So yes, definitely AI and bots are probably number one right now when it comes to cybersecurity.
Has your house position changed at all? When you're talking to business leaders, business owners out there who are like, I mean, I'm doing everything I can at the moment, but we're still getting hacked, we're still getting attacked. What more can we do? What's your advice to those businesses out there now?
It's very hard. So there is nothing that you can do that guards you 100%.
Mm.
I guess that keeps us in business for that reason. It's one of those things, right? It's like I always compare it to a car. You can buy the best car, seat belts, airbags, and insurance. Will that prevent you from getting an accident? Absolutely not. Mm. I mean, if you're the best driver, even Schumacher driving down the street, someone can just come around the corner and hits them. So that it's the same reality in the cyber world. If you, even IBM, even cybersecurity companies, we're under attack every day. Mm. Every day. We get about maybe 15 to 20,000 phishing emails. You know, if you hack a cybersecurity company, hey, you get a bunch of awards, right? So, we have to dedicate a huge amount of resources and time just to protect ourselves,
yeah.
Right? So, it's a game that keeps going on.
Well, thankfully, you're ahead of the game. That's for sure. And great to have you join us live here in studio. And thanks to you and all your team for helping us sleep safer of an evening in light of all those cyber attacks. Amir, thanks so much indeed for your time. Lovely to see you.
Thank you for having me.
Explaining that one in more detail to us as well. Amir Kolizadeh is the founder and the CEO of ITSEC. Here in the UAE.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com. You've been listening to a DubaiEye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from DubaiEye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.